Welcome to Historical Nerdery, the show that destroys the myths of the American Revolution, one podcast at a time. I am your head nerd, Alexander Kane. On today's pilot episode, we're going to explore 18th century Lexington society and learn about the people who helped ignite the war for independence. I hope you will join us today on Historical Nerdery. So let's get into the show. The village of Lexington was known until 1713 as Cambridge Farms. It was located northwest of Boston, nestled among the surrounding towns of Menotomy, which is now known as Arlington, Bedford, Lincoln, Waltham, and Woburn. Sprawled out over 19 square miles, Lexington consisted of approximately 10,000 acres of fertile fields, gentle hills, woodlands, and peat bogs. And the town was crossed by gently meandering streams that eventually found their ways to either the Charles or Mystic Rivers. In 1711, at the suggestion of Samuel Stone, the residents of Lexington purchased from Massachusetts Bay Colony an acre and a half of land where the Concord, Bedford, and Boston roads met. From this resolution, a village common was created that instantly became the physical, political, religious, and military center of the town. The common, or green as it was sometimes called, was roughly triangular in shape. It was bounded on the south by the road to Concord, running southeast to southwest, and on the east side by the road to Bedford. On the north, there was a narrow dirt track that joined the Bedford and Concord road. Buckman Tavern, as well as its stables and outbuildings, stood directly across Bedford Road from the easternmost point of the common. Built in 1710, the structures functioned to accommodate drovers bringing herds to market in Boston, as well as Lexington residents attending Sunday services or town meetings. Across from the Bedford Road, in the angle formed by the Bedford and Concord Road, stood the town meeting house. The first meeting house was erected in 1692, but had been replaced by a larger structure in 1713. This meeting house was a great barn-like structure with two tiers of galleries and a main floor that consisted of high-walled pews. The town meeting house served as the town hall, a church, an assembly place, and an arsenal. Approximately 400 feet behind the meeting house was a schoolhouse where from October to March, the children of Lexington were instructed in the basic skills of writing and reading by either an underpaid Harvard graduate or the town minister. To the rear of the meeting house, on the south side of the common, stood a belfry. Initially, this belfry had been used to warn residents of possible attacks by the French and Native Americans. However, by the eve of the American Revolution, it served a more peaceful purpose of summoning residents to church or town meetings. Although several families had lived in Lexington for generations, most of the population was actually made up of newcomers seeking to exchange their lives in Boston or Salem for better ones in Lexington. From the 1640s onward, Lexington's population grew by 100 people per decade. This population boom, if you want to call it that, had a direct impact upon the natural and social environment of the town. As new residents moved in, more woods had to be cleared, fields cultivated, and the rich peat swamps harvested. This process continued for over a century until the French Wars of the 1740s and 1750s, when immigration to Lexington virtually stopped. By 1775, Lexington was inhabited by approximately 100 families that included 750 people, 7 enslaved persons, and 400 cows. Many of the townsmen subscribed to mixed husbandry farming, which encouraged farmers to produce a variety of items necessary for survival. Such items included vegetables and fruit, and wood for fuel and shelter. To generate such supplies for the long term, Lexington farmers needed approximately 60 acres of land. According to research conducted by historian Mary Babson Fuhrer, Approximately 2 to 4 acres of land was allocated to an orchard and home. Now, the average Lexington family burned about an acre of wood per year. So as a result, an additional 20 to 30 acres of land was needed to be set aside as a woodlot. On top of that, another 6 acres had to be designated as tillage, which was designated to generate grains for bread and flax for linen. However, to remain productive, tillage needed to be fertilized with cow manure. And of course, cows needed to be fed. So at least 15 acres of land was usually set aside as grazing fields, while an additional 15 acres was designated for hay to feed cows and other livestock during the winter. On the eve of the American Revolution, farmers in Lexington had roughly allocated only 10% of their land as tillage, 25% as pasture and hay fields, and 40% as woodlots. Life on colonial Lexington farms was very much guided by the changing of the seasons. In the winter months, men felled, hauled, and chopped firewood. Because farmers had to feed precious hay to any animals they hoped to winter over, November, December, and January were a time of slaughtering. Of course, the cold helped preserve the fresh meat until women had a chance to salt it or turn it into sausages. By early spring in March and April, farmers began their season by turning gardens and plowing their tillage land. Of course, they were faced with the difficult task of gathering the winter's manure and ashes and carting them to the tillage fields to be spread and plowed into the soil as fertilizer. In the months of May and June, while farmers plowed, sowed, and weeded, Lexington women turned to the work of dairy. Women would often continue cheesemaking until the heat of July impeded their work. In the summer months of July and August, all available men turned their hands to the hay and grain harvest. During this same time, women would often do extra loads of laundry and cook extra meals for hired harvest help. In autumn, men worked to bring in the harvest of fruits, vegetables, root crops, and squashes, while Lexington women preserved them by either making barrels of applesauce, apple vinegar, and apple molasses, or actually canning or jarring the fruits. Interestingly, Lexington cider mills ran nonstop, turning as men produced barrels of that most essential colonial beverage. The Reverend Jonas Clark's diary entries between 1766 and 1775 highlight some of the daily and monthly tasks he undertook to maintain his own farm. In January, he noted that he would retrieve wood from the swamp, blousing logs, sledding wood, and killing hogs. In April, Clark began to garden, as well as making soap. According to his diary, in June, the Lexington minister was weeding and performing odd jobs, including weeding corn, moving dung to the yard, carting dung and ashes, fishing, and building and making walls. In October, Clark was getting in cider making and gathering corn. Cooperation and mutual welfare were common customs in Massachusetts towns and villages. Residents actually assisted each other with a variety of tasks and in a number of emergencies, including preparing meals, building homes, plowing, felling timber, caring for one another when ill or injured, or simply offering counsel and advice. This concept of interdependence spilled over into Lexington's economy as well. When goods or services were exchanged, cash was rarely utilized in Lexington, as well as most of Massachusetts Bay Colony. Instead, transactions on the local level were recorded in the form of debts and credits. Debts were listed in the terms of monetary value and recorded by the creditors in account books. At any time, a yeoman could be both a creditor and a debtor. Economic success not only required tolerant creditors, but shrewd debtors able to avoid settlement too quickly or frequently. And of course, manual labor was the commodity most frequently exchanged on the local level. If there was either an individual need or a general demand for items that could not be produced locally, such as gunpowder, high-grade cloth, perhaps needles and pins. Local residents such as William Monroe purchased the goods in Boston, Salem, or Newburyport, and then resold them in his own store in Lexington. Because of this economic system, the web of interdependence was strengthened and families continued to rely heavily on one another. Therefore, the economy served as a powerful social cement, promoting community cooperation and neighborly behavior at all levels. The extent of cooperation did, however, have its limits. The increase in Lexington's population in the early 18th century, coupled with a fixed supply of land available as an inheritance, forced many young men in Lexington to seek land north or west of Lexington. Purchasing smaller tracts inside of Lexington or share with their brothers a divided inheritance was just not the best option. Even worse, by the eve of the American Revolution, many Lexington residents were actually saddled with overwhelming debt. In 1759, 15% of Lexington men saw a forced sale of all or part of their real estate to settle debts at the time of their death. By 1779, that percentage actually rose to almost 29%. And by the end of the American Revolution in 1783, a staggering 40% of Lexington estates faced forced sales. Although society in 18th century Lexington was fluid, it wasn't fluid as today. Many New Englanders believed that upper orders of society were expected to rule, while lower society were expected to obey. Lower class citizens were often viewed with contempt and disdain if they attempted to assert influence or power beyond that expected of their station, and they were quickly reminded of their proper place in society. Leaders in New England society had to be men of distinction, respected by all. By 18th century standards, failure to adhere to these societal structures would not only result in disorder, chaos, and anarchy, but would also anger God. The clergy stood at the pinnacle of 18th century Lexington society. Due to their own considerable talents, and bolstered by the religious doctrine of the 17th century, the Reverend John Hancock and his successor as pastor, Jonas Clark, were the two most important individuals in Lexington society. As ministers, they were the spiritual and moral leaders, the political commentators, and, when the town was without a school teacher, the educators as well. The minister held an unchallenged position within society. The minister's function was to help maintain stability and order within Lexington. Thus, Lexington ministers frequently set aside their personal needs for the benefit of Lexington as a whole. In times of need, citizens naturally turned to their ministers for assistance, and frequently, Jonas Clark involved himself in settling the daily squabbles that arose between residents. Similarly, the Reverend Hancock often settled land disputes by driving a stake into the ground and telling those involved parties that the stake was the boundary and there would be no further debate on the issue. Below the ministers stood the selectmen and other town leaders. These were the substantial yeomen and tradesmen who usually had greater wealth and held more property than the average Lexington farmer. These leaders were viewed as the role models for the doctrine that success could only be attained through hard work. Their positions also entitled them to other benefits, including first choice in the purchase of family pews and burial plots, and the right to represent Lexington in the House of Representatives in Boston and the Massachusetts Provincial Congress during the early years of the War for Independence. Individuals rarely exercised local political leadership until they had reached middle life and achieved economic independence. It was assumed only those who had established a place in society, whose accumulation of property ensured that their interests depended on no man, they could be relied upon to wisely lead the community. Between 1769 and 1779, 27 of the town's selectmen were between the ages of 50 and 59. Another 17 were between the ages of 40 and 49. No one under the age of 30 served as a selectman. Thus, dependent sons, laborers, poor farmers, and servants had no right to accept leadership position. Below the town politicians in the social order was the general male population, or the yeomen. Hardworking and dedicated to their beliefs, these men were concerned primarily with the raising of their families and the cultivation of their farms. A review of Lexington tax valuations of property in 1774 reveals that the wealthiest resident of Lexington was William Reed, who was assessed 16 shillings and 1 pence for his property. The town's poorest resident, Ephraim Winship, was assessed a mere 10 pence. As such, most of the residents in Lexington were considered yeomen. The average Lexington yeoman owned at least 5 cows, 2 oxen, at least 6 acres of tillage, and produced at least 60 bushels of grain per year. A yeoman could vote in town election and participate in town meetings if he had resided in Lexington for 1 year, was at least 21 years old, and possessed an estate that would rent for at least £3 a year, according to the valuation of a local assessor. As in many other towns, the average Lexington farmer made up the rank and file of the militia. He could read, possessed high moral standards, and was often easily influenced by the Whig propaganda emanating from Boston. His daily duties began at dawn and continued almost without interruption until after sunset. Beneath the yeomen were the landless and the poor. By 1774, nearly one-third of Lexington men were landless. Many were young men, transients, or non-inheriting sons who had remained in the town. More troubling, however, was the number of poor who were dependent upon the town for support. In 1764, there were 12 individuals who were dependent upon the town of Lexington. By 1775, the number doubled to 24. To curb the rise of government dependency, the town resolved to prosecute any resident who allowed non-resident poor to reside in their homes without first seeking permission of the selectmen. Fines assessed for conviction of minor misdemeanors were to be diverted to the support of the poor, as was rotted and old wood found on town property. Popular belief to the contrary, slavery did exist in Massachusetts, and there were slaves living in Lexington at the outbreak of the American Revolution. In fact, slavery had existed in Massachusetts from its founding. On the eve of the American Revolution, 7 enslaved people resided in Lexington. The largest slaveholder was Samuel Hadley, with 3 servants. In some households, male slaves worked side by side with their masters as coopers, blacksmiths, shoemakers, and wheelwrights. In other Lexington homes, enslaved persons ran errands, functioned as valets, and performed the heavy work of their masters. The few female slaves in Lexington were required to carry out the various household tasks their mistresses demanded. Curiously, Massachusetts slaves were not without rights. Unlike slaves in the southern colonies, New England slaves could hold property, did serve in the militia, as was the case with 5 of Lexington's slaves, Prince Esterbrook, Pompey Blackman, Samuel Crafts, Cato Tudor, and Jupiter Tree. And enslaved persons could testify in court against both white and other blacks. On rare occasions, they were permitted to petition the colony for legal assistance. In 1774, several African Americans addressed the Massachusetts General Court and demanded that they too have the right to enjoy the benefits of liberty. Similarly, a slave could also sue for freedom, as was the case with a female mulatto slave named Margaret. On November 20, 1770, Margaret appeared in a court in Cambridge, Massachusetts, represented by a local lawyer named Jonathan Sewell. John Adams, yes, that John Adams, who was currently in the midst of the Boston Massacre trial, represented her masters, the Muzzy family of Lexington. At the end of the hearing, which lasted most of the day, the court freed Margaret. Still, we have to recall, slavery was a degrading and inhumane institution. A slave could not move in search of opportunity or even travel outside of Lexington without his or her master's assent. If he or she was discovered, a slave could be prosecuted as a fugitive. An enslaved person could only marry with the master's blessing, and interracial marriages was absolutely illegal. An enslaved person's wife and children could be sold to another owner at his master's whim. Finally, a slave was always subject to both actual and potential cruelty for which there was no defense. If a slave struck a white man, he would be summarily and severely punished. On Boston Neck, travelers were presented with the view of a cage. Inside the cage contained the bones of Mark, a slave who had been convicted of murdering his master. The spectacle was intended to serve as a constant reminder to slaves in Massachusetts Bay Colony of the potential penalties for defiance. The women of Lexington occupied the bottom rung. According to extensive research conducted by historian Janice Potter McKinnon, prior to the American Revolution, most women were bound by the legal and moral codes of their respective communities. Life was not easy for women. From the perspective of society, women were assumed to be helpless because they were like children who could not provide the basic necessities for themselves, but had to rely on men for assistance, shelter, and clothing. But they were also helpless, it was thought, because they were inferior. They could not take care of themselves because they were less rational, capable, and competent than men. Not only were women treated as helpless inferiors, they were also expected to speak of themselves in these terms. Women in many of the American colonies could not attend public school, were often pregnant on their wedding day, and received little protection from domestic violence. Women were often heavily dependent upon the companionship of their sisters and other female relatives. Siblings often spent countless hours spinning, preparing food, making soap, and working in the field together. Females also assisted each other in the birthing and raising of children. Often the major decision in a woman's life was the choice of a mate. Although 18th century women did have some say in the selection of a spouse, parents still played a significant role in the decision, and their consent was required by Massachusetts law. Colonial-era women were expected to obey their husbands, rear the children, cook and prepare meals, make and launder clothes, and undertake minor household repairs. Basic to the marriage contract was the notion that the man had the power to make the important decisions for the family unit. And under the eyes of Massachusetts colonial law, a married woman could not vote, collect wages, make contracts, testify in court, serve as a juror, buy or sell real property, nor execute a will on her own. However, not all women were subject to the strict rigors of Lexington society. An unmarried woman was considered a femme sole. According to McKinnon, a femme sole could sign contracts, own a business, control her own wages, buy and sell real property, and distribute personal property and chattel in a will. A femme sole could also sue or be sued in her own name in a Massachusetts colonial court of law. Some femme soles were able to establish employment as midwives, newspaper owners, successful seamstresses, tavern keepers, and shopkeepers. Such positions enabled to work within the accepted sphere of gendered societies, and or sometimes in a rare occasion, in conjunction with family members, husbands, or business partners. Of course, the status of the femme sole afforded women the most freedom, but it was publicly and socially discouraged, since again, women were viewed as unproductive if they were not wedded and having babies. And of course, the treatment of teenage pregnancy in 18th century Lexington also highlights the wide disparity between men and women on the eve of the American Revolution. In the 1740s, 19% of all first births were prenuptial conceptions. From the 1740s onward, births less than 9 months after marriage steadily increased. By 1774, 41% of all firstborn children in Lexington were conceived out of wedlock. According to Robert Gross, author of The Minutemen and Their World, on the eve of the American Revolution, one out of three firstborn children were conceived out of wedlock. And of course, Lexington youth were no exception to this growing trend. In the 18th century, the birth of illegitimate children was treated as criminal in nature and punished by the imposition of a fine. Almost always, it was solely the mother of the bastard child that was prosecuted. On the eve of the American Revolution, several Lexington girls were prosecuted for teenage pregnancies. Religion in the 17th and 18th centuries was part of the very lifeblood of Lexington. From the establishment of Cambridge Farms to the arrival of the Reverend John Hancock in 1698, Lexington citizens subscribed to the Calvinist theory of Puritanism. The origins of this religion can be traced back to England, where the movement was an attempt to continue the Protestant Reformation by further purifying the Church of England. The spread of Puritanism in England received a temporary check when, under Charles I, the Declaration of 1628 named the king as the supreme leader of the church. The government then imposed immediate restrictions on Puritan sermons and publications and began to imprison those who ignored the injunctions. 20,000 Puritans, rather than submit to these restrictions, chose to leave England, eventually arriving in New England, where they established their Church in the Wilderness. Following the execution of Charles I at the end of the English Civil War, Oliver Cromwell rose to power. Under Cromwell's protectorate, Puritans gained another temporary reprieve and the freedom to practice their beliefs. However, with Cromwell's death and under the restoration of the monarchy under Charles II, prosecution and persecution of Puritans resumed. Those responsible for the execution of Charles I and those who continued to espouse the Puritan doctrine were once again forced to choose between emigration or continued punishment in England. As a result, a second wave of Puritans left England and fled to New England, where they were free to openly practice their faith. In the midst of this church in the wilderness was Lexington. Its residents, like most of Massachusetts Bay colonists, adhered to a strict form of Calvinism characterized by Evangel Jehovah and ministers imposing the laws of Christ upon their flocks. Parishioners were required to submit themselves to the authority of the local minister and only could become full members within the church if they entered into a personal covenant with God. Membership was restricted to those elite who could demonstrate to the minister and a panel of select parishioners God's presence in their lives. It was this privileged group who were admitted to the Lord's Supper and who oversaw the business of the church. In the aftermath of the Salem witch trials, however, the religious fervor of Lexington waned, church membership dwindled, as fewer residents stepped forward to proclaim their covenant with God. But with the rise of the Great Awakening in the 1740s, new lights welcomed the energetic and emotional sermons of popular ministers. Likewise, laymen were allowed to preach from the pulpit. Ministers from other towns and parishes were invited to speak, with morality becoming the underlying theme of many sermons. Emotion and extravagant gestures replaced solemn hymns and prayers. Lexington residents were instructed to judge and interpret the laws of Christ on their own. Many Lexington residents rejected the following of the old lights. From the perspective of the new lights, the privileges of the elites, the restrictive religious ceremonies, and the selective church membership were considered offensive and contrary to church teachings and doctrine. And of course, the Reverend Hancock recognized that the Great Awakening could create a split in his congregation, as it did in Concord and other communities. Rather than drive a wedge through the members of his church, Hancock adopted a position of compromise. On the one hand, Hancock found the emotional practices of the new lights unacceptable and troubling. On the other hand, the Reverend took advantage of the religious awakening to draw in new members. During his tenure, Lexington ministers encouraged individual thought, freedom of conscience, and community piety. Hancock even went as far as to encourage the adoption of a choir and the singing of Isaac Watts hymns. During his tenure, the Reverend Hancock successfully drew in over 80 new church members, and he even endorsed the concept of a halfway covenant. Despite this liberal approach to the religion, the basic tenets of Puritanism remained intact in Lexington, well into the era of the French and Indian War. Men still adhere to the belief that the Lord directly interposed his hand in worldly affairs. This providential concept of reality had the profound impact on those expectation of New Englanders. In their minds, God visited both blessings and chastisement upon those he loved. He rewarded those deserving of reward, but expected them in turn to offer thanksgiving for his blessings. Conversely, God punished those who deserved punishment. And those who failed to acknowledge the Lord's workings, or even worse, committed the sin of pride, would feel the wrath of God. Diaries and journals of Massachusetts provincial soldiers during the French and Indian War were filled with references to the Lord's disciplinary actions. Included among these were chastisements of freak weather storms, disease and starvation, accidental death, and finally, defeat in battle. Most New Englanders believed that it was only through the Lord's working that a collective effort such as a war could succeed. Unless the group as a whole conformed to his purpose, none were of use to him. The idea of liberty was an important component of Puritan theology. However, an individual's liberty depended not on his financial circumstances, but rather upon his moral character. Liberty was related to sobriety of conduct and integrity of life. Liberty was ordered, just as life was ordered. To obtain freedom, one was expected both strive individually and work cooperatively within the community. The divine lesson imparted on Lexington residents was to obey God, and then through the firm collective obedience of all individuals, liberty could be attained. On the eve of the American Revolution, the unique position of the minister within Lexington guaranteed Clark would play a significant role in the unfolding political drama. When the revolutionary crisis began in 1765, the Reverend Clark, already the community's spiritual leader, quickly emerged as its political leader as well, and the voice of Lexington's opposition to British policy. Through his skilled diagnosis of the issues, Jonas Clark ensured Lexington's unity against England. He gradually drew the townspeople into a national debate and accustomed them to the idea and practice of acting on a broad political stage that extended beyond mere town affairs. His influence shaped attitudes and molded public opinion. And during his tenure in Lexington, his sermons included such themes as the importance of military skill, measures for defense, a martial spirit in a time of peace, and the fate of blood. Each time Parliament passed a series of new acts affecting Massachusetts Bay Colony, Jonas Clark wrote long, closely reasoned responses that were quickly adopted and endorsed by the citizens of Lexington at their town meetings. For example, when the Stamp Act crisis arose, Clark called it a door to numberless evils which only time can discover. In 1768, he condemned the quartering of troops in the colonies as an infringement of their natural, constitutional, and chartered rights. In 1773, following the passage of a tea tax, Jonas Clark argued that any Lexington citizen who purchased or consumed tea should be looked upon as an enemy of the town and shall be treated with neglect and contempt. When the Intolerable Acts were passed, Lexington concluded, again under the guidance of Clark, that the time had come to prepare for war. Quickly, the town's resolve was voiced. We shall be ready to sacrifice our states and everything dear in life, yea, in life itself, in support of the common cause. New England's Puritans had always considered the defense of their religious views as essential to their prized English liberties. Recognizing this principle, Clark carefully linked English rights and liberties to theology. Clark saw the colonists of Massachusetts Bay Colony as the chosen people who were tasked with the responsibility of reestablishing Israel's purity of worship and moral authority. Thus, the Massachusetts people were required to defend their chosen land. As Clark declared in 1768, the preservation of the rights and liberties of the people was, in fact, the cause of God. Militiamen who engage in the cause of God's people and set themselves for their defense are therefore to consider themselves as guardians and trustees for God, having their rights, properties, liberties, and lives of their fellow men a sacred trust committed to their charge. In 1763, Clarke wrote, "We shall have and enjoy all liberties and immunities of free and natural subjects within any of His Majesty's dominions." As the years passed and grievances mounted, Clarke began to lay the groundwork for an assertion of rights independent of those granted by the Crown. As the Massachusetts Assembly defied British ultimatums, some provincials, including Clarke, held that the Crown and parliamentary powers were not without limit. Drawing on Enlightenment philosophy, Clarke contended that in a state of nature, every man has a right to liberty, property, and life, and no one can reasonably deprive him of either. Through his tireless efforts, Clarke not only created a political climate in Lexington that was well ahead of most of Massachusetts town, he also influenced the public opinions of many other clergymen and statesmen within the colony. On the eve of the Battle of Lexington, Clarke often journeyed outside of his town to neighboring communities to give guest sermons, attend political rallies, offer lectures, and observe business matters. Clarke became so popular, he was frequently asked to serve as a guest speaker at clergy ordinations. In fact, so many of the clergy followed Clarke's example that by the eve of the battles of Lexington and Concord, British General Hugh Earl Percy put forward the following complaint in a letter to his father. "I am sorry to say that no body of men in this province are so extremely injurious to the peace and tranquility of it as the clergy. They preach sedition openly from the pulpits. Nay, some of them have gone so far as to absolutely to refuse the sacrament to the communicants till they have signed a paper of the most seditious kind, which they have denominated the Solemn League and Covenant." So much with respect to the inhabitants. As the Lexington militia anxiously awaited the approach of regulars in the early morning of April 19, 1775, the Reverend Clarke was confident that he had adequately prepared his people for the coming conflict. As Clarke had forewarned a little over a year earlier in January 1774, "Our worthy ancestors, after many struggles with their enemies, in the face of every danger and at the expense of much treasure and blood, secured to themselves and transmitted to us, their posterity, a fair and rich inheritance, not only of a pleasant and fertile land, but also of invaluable rights and privileges, both as men and Christians. We look upon ourselves as bound by the most sacred ties to the utmost of our power to maintain and defend ourselves in our charter rights and privileges, and as a sacred trust committed to us to transmit them to succeeding generations." I hope you have enjoyed today's pilot episode of Historical Nerdery. To learn more about the battles of Lexington and Concord, as well as other neat information about revolutionary New England, be sure to check out my website, historicalnerdery.com, and subscribe to my mailing list. I am Alex Kane, and this has been Historical Nerdery.